Hello and welcome to Out of the Frame, conversations about photography. I'm Pia Johnson, your host, and this podcast features conversations about photography, creativity, and the world we live in. I'll be talking to other photographers, curators, academics, and researchers about their work, artistic process, and how they feel about contemporary photography today. Out of the Frame acknowledges the people of the Woiwurrung and Bunurong language groups of the Eastern Kulin Nation, on whose unceded lands we record each episode from. We respectfully acknowledge ancestors and elders, past and present. It was, and always will be, Aboriginal land. This is a special thematic episode based around the notion of queer voices. I've been able to speak to three artists from the Photo 2024 Festival: Clifford Prince King, Alicia Wilson-Hetty, and Sunil Gupta with his partner Sharam Singh. My next guest is Clifford Prince King. Clifford is a self-taught artist based in New York and Los Angeles. King documents his intimate relationships in traditional, everyday settings that speak on his experiences as a queer black man. In these instances, communion begins to morph into an offering of memory. It is how he honours and celebrates the reality of layered personhood. With King's images are nods to the beyond, shared offerings to the past manifest in codes hidden in plain sight, known only to those who sit within a shared place of knowledge. Public collections holding his work include the Hammer Museum, Clefeld Contemporary Art Museum, Los Angeles County Museum of Arts, ICA Miami, Minneapolis Institute of Art, and Studio Museum in Harlem. Publications carrying Kim's images as commissioned work and features include Appartamento, Aperture, Butt, Cultured, The Cut, Dazed, Fantastic Man, Freeze, Gagosian Quarterly, ID, Interview, T Magazine, The New York Times, Vice, Vogue, and The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much for joining me, Clifford.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's really great to have you for the festival. And I thought we might just begin by, if you don't mind, in you introducing yourself and your interest in photography and filmmaking.
Yeah, I am self-taught. You know, I kind of just grew up with cameras, you know, disposable cameras, older film cameras, VHS camcorders that my dad had growing up. And I watched a lot of movies. Being from Arizona, it's really hot during the summer, so I would stay inside most of the time and just watch movies. And I really fell in love with cinematography and then started taking photos.
Can I ask which, like, what are some of your favorites from that period?
I really loved Buffalo 66 and Wes Anderson. Like, I was really drawn to those indie films that were just really simple, and you know, there's obviously a certain aesthetic to how the camera is moving, you know, like the wide shot, the slow zoom in like a French New Wave film. So I think that's kind of what drew me into just the still image. It's just kind of really creating a feeling amongst something just paused.
And the color too, I think there's it's a very particular type of color treatment that was definitely Wes has, but lack of
like
that
warmth and, warm and some grain.
Yeah, but the camcorder thing too, you know, everything was very warm.
Yeah, I just liked for things to feel very not hyper-digital, or I still like when things feel very timeless. And so I feel like with film, it's just better for me to execute that with than digital, because digital is obviously always changing, and there's programs and software and all of that. So I feel like film and 35 millimeter and medium format is all just very timeless.
But also nostalgic too. There is something about that. I kind of, I feel like that idea of you being a kid in a hot summer, you know, watching indie films is a very particular kind of vibe. And I wonder, is that something that you think is still kind of part of that making process or visual language?
Yeah, I think I feel in good company when I say that a lot of creative processes are had when you're kind of isolated. And I did feel quite isolated in high school. So by watching movies on Tumblr a lot, just kind of subconsciously sourcing just visuals and art that I was just stumbling across on the internet, and then just diving into movies and just kind of allowing things to approach me organically in a creative way.
So when did you, I guess, claim the artist or photographer, filmmaker role then, if it was quite an organic, I guess, beginning?
I don't know. I still kind of have a hard time vocalizing that. I mean, I do now, but it's kind of like something I say under my breath, or kind of I'll laugh when I do it, because, you know, I think maybe I'm a little too aware of just like the industry and how it can just feel very like, oh yeah, I'm a filmmaker. I'm like just bios with like all the commas of the things they do.
Yeah.
And it just kind of gives me like a weird like I don't want to like, but I.
But you have a bio that has all the commas. I know. I just read it before.
Yeah. You know? I mean, you know, you have to, I feel like you have to claim what you want and speak things. Even, I guess it's a bit of an imposter syndrome sometimes, but yeah, I think this past year and a half, I've had to just go with it and demand certain things and just, you know, take up space.
I think there's something really liberating when you can get to that point. I'm terrible at taking up space too. Right. And I'm very like, oh, no, no, I'll do whatever you need to do so that I can have my work in that spot. And now I've also been encouraged to like actually lean into being the artist and your values and what you want. And I think, when you can get there, I think it's a really good spot. But I think the imposter syndrome is definitely real.
It's like a mixture between like imposter syndrome and then kind of like a recovering people pleaser mindset. So like, it's like, I don't want to say
I'm with
that,
you.
You know, so it's coming together. I feel like I'm at a point where I can just kind of say no to things, or, you know, if something doesn't feel somewhat within my world or a zone of interest, then I can just politely decline or just...
Yeah, nice.
You know.
Yeah, great. Talking about, you know, claiming stuff, I mean, you're here for the Photo 2024 Festival, and you've got a series called Orange Grove that is being presented, which also... You published a book of the same title in 2022, is that right? You know, I feel like there's something very personal about that particular series of work, and I think you've expressed previously that the work is very much a self-expression of you at, you know, and your identity at its fullest. Could you expand a little bit more about how the project began and also the way it evolved?
Yeah, well, after being in Arizona, I moved to Portland, Oregon. Didn't go to school, just kind of tried to explore what it is I wanted to do. But then I moved to, this is like the very long version.
That's okay. We have time.
I moved to LA and I moved in with my friend who is also from Arizona. But he had been in LA a few years before I did. So he was kind of immersing himself within Black artists and LA culture. And, you know, he does hair and like hair sculptures. And so, you know, I moved in with him on Orange Grove Avenue, and it kind of just felt like this opportunity to start over as like a more realized person. You know, I had been in a relationship with a man in Portland. I just felt as though being in LA at that point with more of a clarity of what I wanted to achieve as far as taking photos or just wanting to be a part of a community that I never felt like I had in Arizona and then Portland. So, you know, LA is very much more diverse And so I just ended up meeting a lot of people in the community, photographing them. But then when Orange Grove kind of came about, it was mostly me photographing men I would meet on dating apps, you know, like hookups. There would be kind of this hour to 2 hour point in time where I would ask if they would let me take their photo, whether that was, you know, covered behind some grapes, or I would always kind of protect their identity just for their kind of just safety.
Yeah.
Or just to make them feel comfortable, or that it wasn't going to just be on the internet or something.
Totally.
But I think within, you know, a few months, I started creating this kind of visual diary, this kind of my own world within my bedroom and within my house, because we didn't really have a lot of money at the time. And so the space was pretty vacant, and it just felt like an apartment that was also used as a studio. And so you have these warm beige colors and brown carpet and popcorn ceilings.
Yeah.
So it was just very much an LA golden hour kind of rendezvous scenario for like about 2 years that went on. So it's kind of a collection of that, as well as just kind of discovering my dynamics with certain people and friendships, relationships, and then kind of processing an HIV diagnosis within all of that. And it kind of just became this very big, you know, mid-20s learning curve. And then I kind of just had this collection that is all just telling of that.
Wow. That's got a lot in there, really.
Yeah.
But it's the work is so poetic and it's so quiet, I feel. Yeah. Like it's really intimate and raw, and you get the vulnerability of your sitters.
Right. Well, I think that comes across because, you know, I took those images not with the intention that, you know, oh, this is going to be a series.
Mm.
This is going to be a book. You know, it's always a thought. You know, I was like, oh, these are going to be something that I'll always have in general. But I think the ease and the calm and quiet beauty that comes from it stems from just letting things kind of take time and marinate and sit, and not applying so much pressure to something to be something before you know what it is.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really lovely way of going about making work, but also probably being quite honest in your journey in that. I know you've spoken to this idea before, but of being in your apartment, in the room, but also that idea of domestic space and inside, outside, you know. And obviously, I didn't realize there were dating app things, so I think that brings another really interesting perspective of maybe only meeting someone for a few hours first before them being photographed or you photographing them. Because I feel there is a sense of playing with the gaze, and obviously being Black male, queer identity, but on top of that, sometimes they feel like, as a viewer, I'm looking at them and I feel like I am sort of looking, you know, and then others I feel much more involved in. I think one comes to mind of the towel, sharing the towel, you know, I feel like I could be in the room with them, you know, where others I'm thinking where it's through a window or something like that. How did you kind of decide, I mean, it does sound very organic, but like those decisions around maybe even just which images you decided to actually exhibit or put in the book, you know, that you're going to go, actually, this is the shot.
Mm.
And that interplay between domestic, inside, very everyday space to those that are, we come from the outside, I guess.
Well, I think a lot of the photos that are, I guess, a little more set up looking, that kind of comes from just being within that certain situation. And then, you know, like even with the towels, like I feel like I was doing that with someone. And then while I was, you know, wiping away, I was like, wait, this is actually really beautiful that we're both doing this. So I kind of step outside myself a little bit and look at the both of us as if I was kind of creating this third person in the room that would see this and just think, oh, wow, this is really beautiful. Like kind of creating a ghost that I can see through or within.
So then you would reset that up,
right?
Yeah?
I would set it up with, you know, two friends whom, know each other very well. In that photo is D'Angelo and Rashad, who are really great friends. And I know them for a long time, so, like, they trust me. And, yeah, I had this, there was this room that was just very beautiful. And we took about 10 photos and kind of quickly. I don't really like to do things super elongated. Like, I want things to kind of be done. Because I think, you know, like, when you're looking at photos or even when you're working in a room with a certain light, after a while, my eyes start to get buggy.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, if I don't get it after 10 frames.
Yeah, you're not going to get it.
I'm not going to get it. Yeah. And, you know, I really try not to focus so much on sharpness or how things, you know, like, I don't want to perfect anything. But, yeah, so most of the works inside that feel sort of like there's this fly on the wall kind of energy. It stems from me looking
back at yourself.
Right, maybe. Looking back at myself, or living in New York and LA, I feel like there are a lot of moments that I would witness on the street of intimacy or just really tender moments between two people. And I would think, oh, that's really cute. That's really sweet. But I want to see that with gay Black men. You know, even just the way someone might pull up someone's backpack right before it falls off.
Yeah.
From behind, you see that. And I kind of want to create those, like, very quick moments that you can't really capture. One, because they're too fast. And two, I don't really feel good about taking random people's pictures on the street. Like, there was a point where that was, you know, fine.
Okay.
But I think now we're in such a time where you can't just do that. Without there being, I'm really avoidant of conflict, so
yeah.
I don't like to make people feel like I'm imposing on their space or their image, so, but yeah, that's where.
But I think it's really interesting to find those everyday moments on the street or, I don't know, wherever you may be in the airport, and then I guess transposing them to your community and to, I guess, representing them as Black male queer moments, maybe. Because then it's an everyday language. Like, we all understand what they symbolize. We all know those moments. But you're actually purposefully kind of going, this can be a Black male moment.
Right. And also, I think even just with photography in general, like, with the way a light might hit a certain area, like, there's all these moments that we see all the time, but they either happen really quickly or we're simply just too busy to notice them. So I really try to highlight moments like that where it's very familiar, but it's almost as if you didn't notice until it's just frozen in front of you. And so I lean toward making images that do that a lot, like even just simple things, like a hand on a hip, looking at the milk, and just like the way someone's standing silhouetted by
the fridge light
and the outfit, just like pauses in time that, you know, we can just be so focused on one thing. And so just like slowing down and looking at the details.
It's a very cinema kind of way of thinking, I feel,
yeah,
right?
We're going
back.
Full circle, we're talking about cinematography. And
well, because I think some film or cinematographers, they make us stop. They make us pause, as you say, and think about those really kind of banal things that we all do that are really human, that make us really human, and we don't have the time. I think you're right. These days we're so in the moment, it's about productivity or where are we getting to next. We don't necessarily see that beauty or, as you say, that light. And so that's kind of interesting, I think, to pull that idea and then but make the still and make it. And then I guess put the still on the gallery wall or in a book that you then spend more time with.
Yeah, because I think in film, like most of my favorite films, there isn't a whole lot of dialogue. I feel like the most powerful scenes in films are the silent ones, where it is kind of maybe just a close-up of the actor's face and you kind of just see the psychological breakdown without any dialogue. And it's very slow. It's one shot. Martha Marcy May Marlene I don't know if you know that film.
I don't know that film.
But I watched that a lot when I was in Arizona. Or like that was kind of like a very good example of that. and like Ingmar Bergman.
Yeah, Ingmar Bergman is amazing.
You know, Cries and Whispers. Yeah. Just like very silent, slow, but you just see things. Just like it's about performance.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I feel like also there's ones like Terrence Davies, like, you know, that just they're slow and they're quiet and it's about light and just life. Like it's laid bare in a way. And as you say, there's just so much that we read without necessarily words.
Right. Because I think our emotions and our feelings are becoming involved versus our brains taking in. So I think if we're watching something, there's like a space within us that is able to receive a feeling versus information. And so I think you just, you get like, you sink into like the ambiance, the surrounding, the characters' kind of thought process and, you know, whatever's going on in the film. I think you're kind of, you're dealing with things the same way the character might.
It's interesting. As a teenager, I used to watch a lot of foreign films. Mm-hmm. Some of them I knew the language, but a lot of them didn't. So I didn't mind reading the subtitles. But I think there's something about having a language gap too that helps when thinking, like, because I am a visual person. Like, I just think all those, you know, Hong Kong films or like Italian films that I watched where I kind of knew what was going on, but it didn't really matter because you just read the images. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a similar way, I think, of taking in all that feeling and emotion.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because even, you know, like, I guess we can go back to Ingmar Bergman. Like, I feel like sometimes I have a hard time with foreign films because I'm trying to read what's going on and then I miss the action. Whereas sometimes, like Black Orpheus.
Yeah.
That, I don't know if you know that film. I know that but film. You can, you don't even need the subtitles. You can just watch it. Yeah. And you can follow along great.
Yeah.
Because it's so, there's so much performance.
Yes.
Like, physical performance. No, yeah, I think...
It's interesting, though, I think, in terms of that translation or the dynamic, because I do feel like they're really different art forms, you know, photography and cinema. They're just, you know, there's different things going on. There's different histories, art histories, and storytelling process is different. Mm-hmm. But I think it's kind of fascinating to look at the kind of overlap, maybe, or the way we read emotion or create emotion from those different places.
Mm-hmm. Especially now.
You know, I think it's so, like, yeah.
People like to turn it off when they're looking at things sometimes, or it's like an escape from emotion. So I think in order to like bring out emotion is kind of powerful now versus, you know, people watch things to forget about their emotions.
Yeah, or to switch off from things, right?
Right.
Interesting. So I guess moving back to your photos and your films, I mean, you know, you really do sort of focus on kind of intimate lives, togetherness, community. Has that come from a place where, I mean, you just sort of said, you know, you've picked up photography and stuff and then you moved to different communities and you're kind of photographing your environment and where you live. But do you think that's something that you're going to keep going with, or that's kind of your natural kind of place where you feel that you've got enough creative license maybe or inspiration from?
Yeah, I think that's kind of, I think, where I'm moving. I don't want to say permanently, but I think my surroundings obviously influence my making a lot. I just moved to New York from LA, so I feel like I have kind of this new terrain to explore. Because I'm not really a series-based or a series-focused photographer. Like, I kind of do things as like a visual diary of sorts, or I'll have an idea and try to like execute it within a few weeks with friends, or all of this is fairly new as well, so I'm kind of just being present and seeing, you know, what kind of comes up for me with some time alone or time in new places.
But that moving around must be quite interesting too, like you're kind of remaking yourself or like your identity, or you know, trying to find the community or the spaces that you want to live in or be within each time, you know, like this is like move number four, right?
Right.
How does that feel?
It feels good. I think if I stay somewhere too long, I feel a little stagnant, especially as a visual person. And I think I'm just at a time in my life where I want to challenge myself and not be too comfortable with things just as they are while I still have some fire under me, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, cool. You know. I hope you have fire all the time, but yes.
I hope so too, but No, I think there's a lot of good things happening in New York right now, and I just kind of want to like immerse myself within the community there and see what happens. Great. Yeah.
Finally, I just want to ask you about kind of this portrait, the portraits that you're making and sort of this everyday lived experience, but also then I guess the notion of representation of queer voices in America today, but even just globally. You know, your work really does do that in terms of a kind of, I won't say activist mode, but, you know, like in a representation mode, you know, I could imagine a lot of younger community looking to your images going, yeah, wow, this is who I am, or this is, I connect to these images, this is the communities I want to live in maybe, you know, and normalizing it for people potentially that may not feel like maybe they haven't come out yet or don't have that support. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about your work kind of taking on that ability, but also like, I guess, politically about you putting that representation sort of out front and in focus?
It's really overwhelming sometimes, in a good way. You know, I think growing up, I really had no references to successful queer life. And they did exist, but I feel like, you know, they were artists who, you know, were lost in the 90s and early 2000s. And, you know, I think by not going to school and maybe studying gender studies or queer theory, you know, I probably would have learned a lot more than I did or didn't.
Yeah, sure.
So I think there is a certain amount of not knowing that I had that I just wanted to create for myself in a non-academic way.
Mm.
You know, I feel like when thinking about art and practice, you know, there's training, there's degrees, there's what is a good photo, critique, and I kind of just didn't want to do any of that. And so I kind of made some, I think I've made something a little more palatable for people who are just everyday people who just want to see something highlighted within themselves, celebrated. You know, I think about, you know, there are images of just queer boys or they, thems, or just being happy together in domestic spaces that aren't broken or in outside places that are beautiful and growing and living great lives. I think that's something that I never saw or thought was something that would be achievable, you know, because most of the things that I saw were, you know, AIDS, you know, or it's like a red lit dungeon with, you know, Tom of Finland characters, and it's very leather, which is, that's great as well. But, you know, there is such a spectrum when it comes to queerness. And I think just showing like the side that I kind of wished to have or to see or to think possible is what I wanted to do. And I think, you know, it's, and there are other people who are doing that as well and who find comfort in making that work, you know, because sometimes you just have to do it. And then
yeah, totally.
It,
yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it's really wonderful that you have, you know, thank mm-hmm. you for doing the work and with such a sensibility too. You know, there is, I feel like, yeah, the word that comes to mind is sort of softness. You're very gentle and it's lovely to meet you and feel that in your presence, but also it kind of connects me more to your images too, I think, which is really lovely to say. but I think it is really important work in terms of, as you say, like the images that you hadn't necessarily seen when you were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And making them now is important, I think, for so many of us and for many, many communities. Thank you so much for coming in today. It was so lovely to chat. Yeah,
thanks for having me. It was lovely talking to you. Yeah.
Alicia Wilson-Hetty is an interdisciplinary artist, activist, community leader, and member of FAFSWAG. She is of mixed Nguyen and European heritage. Alicia is one of the producers for FAFSWAG Art Collective, producing live performance, public programming, community events, panels, podcasts, and activations over the past decade. FAFSWAG is a queer Indigenous arts collective committed to social change through art and cultural activations.
Formerly trained as a performer for the stage and film at Best Training and Unitech in Auckland, Atuera. Alicia has featured in works for Auckland Fringe Festival, Auckland Pride, Sydney Biennial and Documenta 15. Her arts community practice is collaborative and intersectional. She was a founding member of the women's collective Dynasty Collective, based in Auckland. In 2019, she was selected for the Basement Theatre Development Program, followed by being a resident producer there in 2020. 2021 saw Alicia step into the role of creative director for Auckland Pride Festival. During her tenure, she co-produced the inaugural Takatāpoi program within the festival, Te Timatanga. Presented Gay Liberation, 50 Years of Resistance and Reclamation, a symposium to mark the 50th anniversary of the Gay Liberation Movement in Atuara. She created, designed and secured funding for a Ratahai Emerging Artist Residency. Late 2022 into 2023 has seen her in a role at Te Taumātātoi Āuiui, the Regional Arts Trust for Auckland, leading their work around advocacy and systems change strategy. She has been hosting a podcast series, Creative Capital, prioritising Māori creative practitioners in Auckland. Complementary to her practice as an artist and producer, advisory and advocacy are a huge part of her practice within the creative ecosystem in Atuara. Having contracted for national arts funding body Creative New Zealand and speaking on multiple advisory and panels for community development.
Hi, Alicia. It's lovely to have you in the studio today. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your career and your work with FastWag.
Yep.
Do you mind starting off and letting us know a little bit about you?
Yeah, sure. So whakalofalahi atu. My name is Alicia Wilson-Hetty. I am of mixed heritage. My dad is Niuean and we come from a little atoll in the Pacific called Niue from the villages of Awasele and Tamakotonga. And then my mum is, well, we're a bit of a fruit salad on that side of our family. So there's English, Welsh, Irish and Scottish lineage on that side of my family. I am an interdisciplinary artist and producer, mostly for live events, which has been interesting terrain to move through over the last few years. And one of the founding members of queer arts collective FastWag, which we have been together now for a decade. And that was started in Tamaki Makaurau in Auckland in New Zealand. I'm also a mama of two boys, Jude and Lennox, and an American bulldog called Chop. And I migrated here to Nam in July of last year.
Wow, thank you. Your life is very full, which is fabulous. How do you feel like you're navigating definitely live performance, but also a really different kind of community here in Nam?
Yeah, I think I'm still finding my feet, truthfully, and just familiarising myself with the city and the community and getting a better understanding, I think, of, yeah, locality. Like, I think locality is really important and what it means to be a guest on this whenua, on this land, and what that looks like, and just getting a better understanding of First Nations people here. There's obviously similarities, I guess, from Māori to mob, but they're also very different as well. And so it's just getting a better understanding of what those things look like and how to honour that properly as a guest here.
Yeah, wow. So FastWag was part of Photo 2024 this year. Can you speak about the work that you guys presented for that?
Yeah, sure. So Alteration, which is kind of a retrospective exhibition of work from the last 10 years. So that exhibition was originally part of Documenta 15, which, yeah, I guess the provocation we were kind of given at the time was like, you know, like, what is the story of FastWag? And so that's kind of was the starting point. And then with the 10-year anniversary of the collective last year, it just made sense to also kind of share that story more. So Alteration had a presentation at home. We took it back to Māngere, which is in South Auckland, to Māngere Art Centre. A version of the show also toured to Imaginative in Toronto. And then, yeah, the collaboration with the substation kind of presented itself and being a new migrant to the city, I was like, oh, actually, this could be really cool and this could be a great way for people to arrive at FISWAG, which is a queer arts collective. Currently, we have 10 people in the collective. At its largest, I think we had a membership of, I want to say, 16. And it was founded by a group of us of, from the top of my head, I want to say it was 5 or 6. And essentially, I think FISWAG is a family. We're friends and we're chosen family. And it has been an incubator or a launch pad, I think, for us to investigate and to probe and to create and ask ourselves questions, but have wraparound supports, I think.
And a community.
Yeah.
And do you think at the beginning, I mean, a while now, I think 10 years is a huge milestone, but that thing of finding a space for, I guess, ideas and artistic works and creative community around kind of queer voices, but also maybe making a mark in the moment of going, this is a
yeah, well, I think at the time, like the landscape when we were kind of starting was very different to what it is now, almost devoid, I would say. Yeah. And so there being a real desire of wanting to create ourselves into existence, I think, and seeing images that look like us and sound like us, and how do you do that? I think ultimately it is just about creating it yourself. And so there was kind of just being tired of not seeing true representations of ourselves, and also the plethora, I think, of what those experiences look like. I think often what happens for queer folk is that there's a monolith, I think, that is applied to these experiences, but every experience is so vastly different. And I think that's a really important conversation that we should be having as a queer community, because often I think people think there's some sort of like queer utopia that we all kind of, you know, operate and live in and work in and play in and thrive in. And that's just not true. There's so many different experiences, intersectional experiences by our community. And so it's just making sure that we're actually seeing what that looks like. There's so much colour there. And so how do we start to be more considerate around what those lived experiences look like? Because like anything, you know, even within the broader queer community, there's still a hierarchy. There's still systemic issues that are faced by our community. And often who is at the top of that hierarchy are white, cis, able-bodied, white, gay men. And so how do we start to shift the paradigm? And it's not about leaving those people behind either, but just finding a more holistic approach to what is happening in the ecosystem of queer community, and how do we foster a more, like fruitful environment for everyone, so that all of those voices are being heard and all of those stories are being told and not just the dominant ones.
I totally agree. I think it's such a complex representation anyway, is a complex idea, but also that intersectionality, that different perspectives can all be valued.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's that thing of responsibility. Like I am only ever making for my experience. I'm not speaking on behalf of, it wouldn't be appropriate anyway for me to be speaking on behalf of my entire community. I am only speaking for myself. And if it resonates with others, amazing. But I think that's often also a pressure that is really put on queer practitioners, that you are now being gifted the flag to fly for an entire community of people. And I just don't, I don't actually think that's fair to put that kind of pressure on people.
No. And I also think that labor needs to be done as a collective, like
definitely
a society and a community, not one person can never represent a group of people.
No.
And I think that's a really interesting thing about this exhibition, actually, is that it is a retrospective, but also you have such a huge diversity of art form, colour, dynamic kind of telling of stories, even mediums. I think that was the thing that, you know, there was so much kind of embedded in each portrait or each story, I think is probably the best way. I think you know, I'm kind of obsessed with stories. I feel like stories allow us into understanding each other in a way.
Definitely.
You know, and then photography on top of that does a really interesting way because it is playing with, I guess it's sometimes a historically violent medium, but also it can pigeonhole in terms of just showing you one version.
Absolutely.
Right? So I think for me the show and the kind of groupings of works really enabled me to kind of go, okay, Fafswag is showing us multiplicity of voices, multiplicity of identities, with even though it is within a kind of queer arena, I think so many people can actually engage with it because they were strong, very dynamic work.
Absolutely. I also think just on that, there's a tapping into cultural knowledge systems that is ancestral. And I think this is the other thing around being a queer brown body in the world is understanding, especially with what is happening in our landscape currently, where there's this really targeted attack on trans and gender expansive people, of this being a new concept. And actually, I reject that entirely because as Indigenous people, we understand that actually transness and gender expansiveness is actually so deeply ancestral. There is a multitude of gender expressions that are so deeply embedded in cultural knowledge systems across the Pacific, but more broadly across the globe in Indigenous cultures, that I think it's so important for us as people to remind people this is not new. And I think this is something that Fafswag as a group of artists does so beautifully, is we're tapping into our knowledge systems. We're tapping into our ancestral cultural knowledge systems to go, we've always been here and we always will. And actually there is a real spirituality that is attached to those identities.
Yeah, and I think there's a power in that too.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's the thing, that it's cross-generational. It's, as you say, so embedded in
culture.
Well,
that's the other thing, right? It's like just to kind of expand out, I think often as well, which gets lost a little bit sometimes in queer spaces and queer community, is we have also, outside of just a shared cultural knowledge and connection and those knowledge systems, we're all a part of a queer lineage. Mm-hmm. And that being a part of a bigger, wider conversation as well, that we have queer ancestors. And so it's also remembering who those people are and their contribution. And that, once again, we are not new. These people are not new. These identities are not new. We have always been here. It's just I think it's that thing again of who has had story sovereignty, who has been the narrator and the author of our stories, and why it's so important. And I always stress this to like young emerging practitioners in the community. It's so important for us to be our own historians. It's so important for us to capture our own stories, whatever medium that might be in, so that we're able to transmission the transmission of that knowledge and information to the generations that are coming up behind us, because we do have this connection point of you're not alone. And I think often for queer people, there is an isolation that I don't think we talk about enough, that, you know, never feel alone, because you're actually connected to this long, rich history outside of yourself.
Yeah, wow. That's really interesting to think about. And I think that's important, as you say, to make sure that the next generations understand that.
Totally. And, you know, I think the other thing that I've been reflecting on a lot in my work and in the different roles that I've had in my career is, yes, there was a big part of our point in our history where we lost a lot of our elders because of the AIDS pandemic, but a lot of those people survived too. Yeah. And so what are their stories? And like, how do we get better at finding those connection points for intergenerational knowledge exchange as well? I think that's really important, because sometimes that can be a bit of a pain point for queer communities around, you know, I think, and I'm speaking very broadly here, sometimes I think there's a tension between our elders and our young people around like, oh, they don't know how easy they've got it.
Yeah.
And also our younger people being like, oh, these elders, like, you know, they've got a chip on their shoulder or whatever. But I think if we could just move through that, we'd actually see that there's so many opportunities to really strengthen our community, yeah. because there's just a wealth of knowledge
yeah.
in both our youngers and our elders. And so how do we create more opportunity for there to be a crossover there too, I think.
Yeah, and a shared flow of understanding.
Yeah, like. I think so. Yeah.
I'm going to shift now and ask you about one of the particular series that features yourself, Only I Can Name Me, which I love the title.
Thank you.
And so you're in the photographs as a model performer along with Ryo Hiroki. And it's photographed by Patty Terrell. Can you talk about that work and how it was created and what it was like being inside the work?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, as we all experience COVID, and in Auckland specifically, in Tamaki Makaurau, we had a lot of, similar to NAM actually, a lot of lockdown periods. So initially, Only I Can Name Me was meant to be a live performance work.
Oh, I see.
And because of... we went from being in, like, I think it was orange to red. And so it was going to be very difficult to actually have people gather. And so it was like, well, okay, we still need to present this work because it was, we were funded by Creative New Zealand. And we wanted to make sure that all the work we'd already done around the conceptualizing of this work and, like, this investigation and what it means to be, yeah, to be, I guess, have sovereignty in your own story mm-hmm. and that you get to name who you are. Nobody else gets to inform that for you. And what does that look like, especially in a queer, fat, brown body that's been socialized very femme as women? Like, what does that look like? And wanting to really celebrate that, wanting to be in, like, what does it mean to sit in ritual? What does it mean to sit in celebration and share that and it be embedded in joy and radical joy? And it shouldn't be radical, but I think when you have those intersectional lived experiences, it is quite a radical offering to be joyful in your body and sit in that and what that looks like. And so, like all things during COVID and as we continue to navigate that as well, it's like, okay, well, how do we pivot? Like, what does the pivot look like? How can we still capture and embody all of that yum stuff that we'd kind of poked our fingers into? And so that's how we ended up going, okay, it was the day before we had to go into full lockdown again. We're like, right, we'd just decided, okay, we'll make this a photographic series instead because there's still so much you can capture through photography.
Yeah.
And we actually shot that in our friend's backyard.
Wow.
So we created this beautiful big altar and then we shot it with Patty, who is just, he's so yum to work with. I love working with Patty and I love the way he captures us as brown people. He does such a beautiful job of being able to really capture people's essence
mm.
and their spirit in a way that I haven't really seen other people be able to do. And so... that's kind of what...
it's a lot of trust there.
Yeah. Oh, high trust model. I mean, it helps that he's one of my best friends.
Okay.
So just for context, like there's a real deep trust of him because he's been a longtime collaborator and he is my chosen family. So I do trust him. But yeah, it was a really beautiful process to, you know, the art direction around that was a lot of fun as well. And there's, you know, always doing things to make it fun for you. And so there's like little hidden gems in the actual altar of like, you know, I put my son's Hulk toy in there and his rabbit and some of my son's like Hot Wheel cars and just having objects of meaning to us as women that was in the altar. Because I think that's also something when we think about, you know, self-care and collective care and what are the things you do for yourself to keep yourself well. It is building those structures, right? It's building those altars, whether they're physical or like internal in your mind. Like how do you build those structures for yourself so that you can feel joy and you yes. can sit in that? And what does that look like when you're sharing it with people? So,
but also giving yourself the permission to feel joy.
Oh, totally. Too, right? Totally.
As mothers, as, yep. even just as human beings, really, it doesn't even, but that thing of going, I'm allowed to sit here and just have this emotion that can ripple across me, and I can think about whatever, but I can feel joy deep inside
Absolutely.
Myself.
And I think also just challenging, I guess, as well, like, because for a long time, fat brown women specifically have been perceived a certain type of way and have been documented a certain type of way, is also just capturing alternative versions of that, because that's just someone's imagination, but it's not my imagination. I don't imagine myself like that. Yeah. And I think that's a key big part, I guess, as a collective of artists as well, is like, how do you really tap into your imagination and what that looks like? Because we are living in someone's imagination and it's not mine. And I'm going to assume it's not yours. So, like, how do we start to shift, I guess, the paradigm around that as well, of, like, when we allow ourselves the time and space to really sit in our imaginations and what we can imagine for ourselves, what does that look like?
Yeah, wow. Well, I've never really thought about it like that. And I think that's really interesting. And I feel like I've got homework to do now, actually. That's really kind of sparked my brain off. But I'm also wanting to know, how do you feel about that performance work moving into photography and becoming photos? And also, just as a side note, did you ever perform the work?
Well, we started to create the physical work, the performance work, and then I think we parked it. And I think it is work that we will probably revisit, because there's stuff there that is still just permeating and kind of like percolating and sitting there.
There's something about it.
Yeah, and I think what I love about photography, and I'm not a photographer, I just like to do the art direction and be in front of the camera too, is that you are able to create something that is a snapshot. It's almost like a timestamp of, this is the person that I was at that very moment, and this is the things that I was thinking about and wondering about and dreaming about and wanting to create something into physical existence at that point. I think with live performance work, which is something that I just love so deeply and is a core part of my arts practice, is there's an energetic exchange that happens with whoever is witnessing it at the time, right? But unless you're very good at documenting that thing that live performance offer, well, where did it even happen? I'm always so aware of that. I'm like, how do you actually like capture that and hold it, put a timestamp on that? And it is, once again, it kind of relies, I think, on really good documentation around, this happened at this time and these people witnessed this thing. Whereas photography, I think, is quite cool, because you do have this physical, tangible thing that you go, on this day, this is what I was dreaming about. Mm. And what a beautiful thing to be able to keep forever. And also thinking about, how will future versions of my community and people with my shared lived experience, how will they look back at this? So I think this is always something I'm kind of in a weird dance with, of being like a current grandchild, or as the kind of framework around that in Aotearoa to Māori is like a mukapuna. How am I a grandchild at this moment, and what is the information I'm receiving from ancestors, elders in this direction, but also the duality of that, of going, how am I being a future ancestor, and what transmissions am I hoping to deliver back to into the future? What am I propelling into the future, and what does that look like? I think is something always permeating in my brain.
Yeah. That's fascinating. I could talk to you forever, especially around the, because obviously I'm a photographer and I document performance. So that is, you know, the thing, and I feel like it is a creative translation.
Yeah.
Right? And I am an artist doing that, and it is my timestamp of your performance right now and how I'm feeling it, rather than that kind of idea of it's just some photo documentation and it's kind of not authored, you know. And so I think it's about how I'm receiving the performance and how I feel creatively to document and photograph and respond to that, or not respond, like not take the picture, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something I always urge anyone who's working in the live performance space to consider when you're making or delivering or performing a thing, or there's that transmission from you as the performer to the people witnessing the performance, is what does that look like for you? Because otherwise it does get lost, and there's so much amazing performance work, right, that gets made and performed and birthed from people that you go, how do you capture that so that you've always got some sort of, how are you being your own historian, really?
Yeah, that's right. And I think, totally biased, but like photos do that for you. They take you, they do time stamp it. You go back to that exact moment of, oh, that was that performance that I was doing that, and oh, we had that moment, you know. Whereas I think there are other mediums that look at documentation in a really different way and aim to do different things. But I think there is something special about deciding when, like, what is the moment that we capture in a photo. And it will be different for everybody. And
totally.
But also for you as the performer and going, I'm the author of this work and working with Patty. But, like, kind of going, this is the moment. This is what I'm trying to communicate and for myself and hold that dear or, you know, as a future history, but all and pass on to your children and your children's children potentially in the community, but also to be authentic to you right now.
Totally.
And it's so powerful and wonderful.
And I think it's just so important that, you know, once again, we're seeing all versions of different people and not just one version and not just one narrative. That's where you can see real cultural shift, I think, is by being able to offer people a real multitude, a multiverse of images of themselves. Otherwise you just, this is, and it's a point of understanding, hey? And I think this is what makes photography and art just such a powerful mechanism for that, is being able to really demonstrate and show there's so much colour. There's so many different little intersections of experiences and identities, and all of that just makes us so much richer, like working from a real abundant mindset opposed to a real deficit, which I think can often plague our sector, our creative sector, definitely, quite a bit, that there's this real deficit mindset, which I also think is kind of like a side effect of colonization too. But we need to move away from that. Like, I think the scarcity model doesn't really purpose any, it doesn't serve anybody. And so how can we start to move from places that are a bit more abundant? And what does that look like?
And harness that and mobilize from there. Thank you so much. It's been so wonderful to chat to you, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sunil Gupta. Sunil is a British-Canadian citizen who was born in New Delhi and has a MA from the Royal College of Arts and a PhD from Westminster. And he lives in London and has been involved with independent photography as a critical practice for many years, focusing on race, migration and queer issues. A retrospective was shown at the Photographers Gallery in London in 2020-21 and the Image Centre Toronto. He is a professorial fellow at UCA Farnham. His latest book is We Were Here, Sexuality, Photography and Cultural Difference, Selected Writings by Sunil Gupta, published by Aperture New York in 2022. His work is in many private and public collections, including the Tokyo Museum of Photography, Philadelphia Museum of Art, Royal Ontario Museum, Tate, Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Museum of Modern Art. He is represented by Hales Gallery in New York and London, Materia Gallery in Rome, Stefan Bulger Gallery in Toronto, and Vedera Art Gallery in New Delhi. Along with Sunil Gupta, I'm speaking to Sharan Singh. Sharan was born in 1978 in India, and his research and practice are informed by his involvement with HIV/AIDS work and community activism that uses the mediums of photography, video and text to explore his pre-English language life, to create artistic resistance through storytelling and fictional fragments to express multi-layered gender experiences and the ephemeral nature of queer desire. His work reclaims subaltern queer identities, subcultures that have been defined mainly as victims. While refusing to form of subjugation, it investigates the institutionalized modes of knowledge productions that are stained with colonial past and are being overshadowed by neo-colonial narratives in India. Simultaneously, he questions notions of the genre of self-portraiture, However, the principal common thread of his works are memory, storytelling, and masculinity. His works have been exhibited at Vetera Art Gallery New Delhi, the Photographers Gallery London, PhotoFest, Houston, G-Fest London, and CPRI New York. Welcome, Sharan and Sunil. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, good morning, Pia. Thanks very much for having us.
I'd love to get a little bit of information and insight on your collaboration and partnership, if you don't mind starting there.
It began really in the making of the work that's on show at Wyndham Art Gallery in Werribee at the moment. It's a series called The New Pre-Raphaelites. And I met Jern around the time I was making those works, at the very start of it, actually, and asked him if he would appear in one of the pictures. And that's partly how we met. Then we got involved with each other, actually, in more intimate ways. And then Jern used to be a social worker in Delhi, and I had been living there for 7 years. This was like halfway, 2008-ish. And so we had a lot of things in common around activism, the fight against 377 to change the law, which was partly the impetus to make the work in the first place, although it was a gallery exhibition. And I let him explain from his point of view how he got involved, both in the series and also how we began to collaborate from then.
Yeah. Hi, Pia. And thank you for inviting me. I think my motivation was to, when I met Sunil, I saw the kind of work that he was making. And also, there was a kind of like this discomfort for me because the work was primarily about people who are English speakers and middle class and living in the center of the city. And very often they will be used even in queer activist spaces. There was a language of reaching out. And the assumption was that the center, they have the center of the culture. And I felt that as an outsider from that space, what can I contribute in that space? And can I contribute actually at all? And when I met Sunil, I think when you have a relationship, intimate relationships like that, you have different way of collaborating, and you also have a different kind of power over each other. And it's not the kind of thing that you would, then the language of reaching out doesn't exist in that space, because we are reaching out in other ways also, right, to each other. And so that way, I think, I got involved with the kind of like helping him for making the work, and then also pursuing him to thinking about how other kind of community can be involved in those kind of conversations and making queer images. So
there was also the whole professional side, you know, where I have this background and training in photography. So, and I'm like very techie and camera oriented and all of that. And he wasn't at all.
Yeah.
He's just looking at it as images. And he had a background and interest in the graphic arts, really. And so he's interested in what things look like. He's not interested in the lens part of it, whereas I was. On the other hand, he was very interested in and had the whole history because of where he came from, of something in India that's called Jugaad, which is like
makeshift.
Making do with what you have, like putting things together. You know, like it doesn't have to be store-bought something. You can actually just, you know, go and get some bits and put it together, you know, like... very good in the studio to kind of put things together. So we had a kind of complementary, some interest like that. And I think the other key thing, before I forget, is that I'll never forget, he once told me that I had a lot of my books with me in my flat. And he said he wanted to know what was in the books.
That's a lovely sentiment.
And that led to...
Yeah, and then education. I think that led me to... I think it was just so curious for me to see the kind of like the whole like the bookshelf was full of books. I mean, the whole room from one end to the other. And I was saying, this is like a library, and do you read them? And then he said to me, on the top of that, he said, oh, but there are a lot of them are queer books. I was like, and so for me was that, you know, my queerness only existed in that social workspace and through HIV program, and it did not have any other social history. There's no cultural history of that space where I was working for 20 years. I mean, not 20, but like now it's 20 years. And so that again, like, became kind of like sparked something in me that, you know, I want to create my history because that history doesn't exist. So one of the picture that I made when I started my MA is that, you know, I'm reading a love letter of my boyfriend or my partner. And you have to destroy that letter because you can't keep that letter because there's no privacy. So this whole idea of privacy also exists for certain class of people. And, you know, it's a very Victorian idea also, the private life and public life kind of thing. And majority of people in Global South don't have private spaces. So the privacy for me exists between when you are now, we are talking to you, you know. So that's the private space for me. It doesn't have to have a kind of physical space. Sometimes it's like an emotional space. Sometimes it's a mental space.
I think there's some really interesting ideas there.
Going back to the series on
show. I was going to ask,
So the work I was developing arose from having visited the Tate in London and seeing a Pre-Raphaelites exhibition. And of course, many of us know it around the world, and often through reproduction. I hadn't really looked at them in the flesh, so to speak, up close and studied them. And something about them struck me as being very close to the moment we were in Delhi at that point. You know, there was a young generation and they were very keen for change and they were tired of the old hypocrisies and middle-class moralities of the country, and they really wanted to have the law overturned quickly and in their lifetime for sure. Unlike my generation, you know, my generation thought, oh, India, it's like, oh, we're 5,000 years old, nothing changes, you just like go with the flow, basically. So they didn't expect any change and they didn't demand any, they didn't get any.
But you left, though, instead, right? You move instead to find change,
yeah,
rather than try and make the change.
Yeah, so my lot, we either put up with it and stayed, or we left, in my case. I left, I mean, and then I tried coming back, but it was too horrific. So I decided I couldn't live there in the 80s, that is. So basically, the pictures then began to be like reconstituting the painting stylistically, with color schemes, with objects, and with situations. And so I think for Charan, he kind of understood that, yeah, we were following a set of paintings, but he hadn't understood yet, without the training, what they represented in their own right, in their own culture.
Could you talk a little bit more about that methodology? Like, I think it's really fascinating. Yes, you're referencing these very famous British, you know, like paintings, and the history and the kind of canon that they sit within and everything they represent, but you find a new language. And it sounds like it's quite a collaboration with your model, but also within the studio. They're very performative.
Yeah.
There's lots of colour and the painted backdrop. They really do feel like you're creating a new set of kind of quintessential portraits. Could you talk more about that and how that idea kind of began?
Yeah, it kind of kicked off in an exhibition that I was invited to participate in. I was given a space, but I didn't have any work to put up. So I created a photography studio on my bit of the wall, basically put up a backdrop and brought some kind of chaise along. And I invited people who had come to the opening to pose in some way. And one of the people who sat for me that day was a man in a green sari, an Indian, you know, women's dress. And he wasn't doing it because he was trans. He was just doing it like a guy in a sari, basically. And so he just kind of draped himself in a certain way. And it was very close to Ophelia, the painting.
Yes.
And so that's the picture we put up the next day. And we printed it, put it up in place of the studio, because then the duration of the exhibition, I had this one picture up. And I was amazed at the response to it. And I began to appreciate that my Indian audience locally may not have traveled to the West to see Ophelia, but they seemed to respond to it. There's something about it that they responded to very positively. And it sort of gave me a license to use a kind of British art historical period to create contemporary work in India for an Indian audience. I wasn't making it for the West. I was making it for a local audience where I was. And it was kind of a gamble, but...
it was a good risk. Yeah.
It was, yeah.
How?
You know, because I find sometimes, because I've moved around a lot in the world, that I find, especially nowadays, we're having this very extreme moment of identity politics and purism.
Yes, the purism is a tricky space, I feel.
Yeah, I'm looking at my Chinese cut on the Indian, looking at my Indian background. Or, you know, so I remember when, you know, the famous shark business with the YBAs, you know, when Damien Hirst did the shark and all that.
Yes.
And Chris Ophelia, an African, a British Afro descended artist, responded by producing elephant dung from Africa. And I was thinking, oh, yeah, what can I get from India, like cow dung? You know, like, it's sort of become very specific to me.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of a gamble. And because I feel at the moment, like, pretty hybrid, because we kind of are, in a way, you know.
Could you talk more about that? I mean, you have moved a lot. There's been a lot of migration and, I guess, mobility within your career. But that must really affect your life and how you feel and that liminal space maybe. I mean, I also come from a family of migrants, so I understand the kind of belonging, not belonging, constantly inside, outside, othering, and then there's the queer lens on top of that.
Yeah.
You know, I think it would be really lovely to hear how that has affected maybe finding your own little space or, you know, or a voice for the ideas.
Well, I think for me, it started when my parents migrated suddenly to Canada. And nobody asked me, you know, so one day in the 60s, they said, you're going to Canada now. One parent sent me to the other one. And then when we got there, so basically it turns out that my parents migrated out of curiosity. They were like tourists.
Wow.
And
can I ask how old you were?
15.
Okay.
High school.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
And so my parents were pretty sure that they hadn't come to become Canadian. They just come to be tourists.
Have a look.
And then because of the kind of economy they lived in, it had to be a one-way ticket like a migrant. But it's like they were economic migrants. But they didn't think they had anything to do with the country, culture. Oh, no. So when I said, so they want to be like Indian at home and ignore like all the other stuff. So me being gay was a terrible shock because it broke through that. As well as when I said I want to do art school, they said, oh, no, because, you know, we're not involved with the culture. You should go to business school or medicine or engineering, which is where Asian boys go.
Yes.
And so I looked at the length of the program and I said, okay, I'll do accounting, the shortest one. But what happened to me, I think, was that being gay became very appealing because when I was in school, being Indian was useless. Nobody had heard of India. So it had no
cachet, understanding.
Nothing, you know. Whereas being gay was overnight was like very fashionable.
Isn't that interesting?
So I found a gay buddy like straight away and we sit in the middle of the cafeteria and dangle our legs and everybody would come.
Wow.
So the Indian thing went out the window straight away. And so we kind of invented a gay liberation, which was very multicultural straight away, you know. And the idea was to, like, it kind of was cross borders. And because the core of it was promiscuity and against family life, so the Asian side just went out the window. It was
against
all
the traditional.
Family building, buying a house, getting a mortgage, having more children, buying more cars and consumerism and all that.
Mm.
So it was a big critique of that. And so that kind of started the ball rolling. And then in the England of the 80s, we had a kind of identity politics around color and culture and black arts, it was called. But it was really like framed in post-colonial terms. Everybody who'd been in heritage was part of the British Empire was black.
Yes.
It wasn't like skin color.
Yeah.
It included the Irish at that point.
Yeah.
And we were moving towards a more kind of international version, away from skin color politics and national politics. And so in the 90s, we went out into the world and bumped up against very entrenched national politics, racial politics. So like we have all these biennales, like the Venice Biennale, it's by country.
Mm.
You know, it's almost like our American artists, our Australian artists, our national gallery. It's all about national, and then our Arts Council funds our artists to be the great thing in Venice, you know. Very hard to break that apart because there's a system that's
well entrenched, you know, and a system we all live by.
Johannesburg Biennial. and the Singaporean artist's work was overshadowed by a gigantic label saying it had been sponsored by the government of Singapore. So the government thing was huge and her work was small. Tiny. So the whole country thing, you know, like there's so much countries use art and culture for diplomatic reasons to put pressure on other people. You know, like you see what's happening with Israel in that letter now to Venice, yeah, saying to not exclude them. Let's see what happens.
Yes. So how do you feel like you've navigated that? And then, you know, you've ended in London.
Yeah, with another Indian.
Which
that wasn't the plan. I don't know how this happened.
Well, but also you've moved to London too. You've gone with Sunil too.
Yes.
How does that feel for you? And shifted careers and moved into the art space?
Yeah. So as you know, as earlier we were talking about that, you know, I was in that space where I was not getting anywhere in HIV programs. And it was almost always was, you know, we are being compared to communities from, you know, US or, you know, and because the majority of the world's, you know, knowledge has been produced, you know, especially the queer knowledge has been produced in English language. Majority of us in India didn't have access to it, especially in my group. In fact, a lot of the people, when I started work, they were having to train themselves into how to write their names. And, you know, so I'm teaching people how to write their names. At the same time, I'm also trying to explain to them that AIDS, acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, is a very, you know, deadly thing for us. So how people would, you know, so now I make work about, you know, how that English term will fit into my mouth, in which I never spoke a word of English in that way, you know. And it's also very specific language, especially when it's related to art or related to health. It becomes a very specialized language. It's not like just, hi, hello, how are you kind of thing. It becomes a specialized space. And so when I thought, I saw that there is a kind of potential in that work, in making that work, and it can travel. As Sunil was saying about the philia, you know, it can read, it can cross boundaries, and it has also other kind of meanings. And then I began to think about, you know, the cultural symbols, and then trying to help him. And one of the other projects that I forced him to do is this Malhotra's Party. So Mr. Malhotra's Party, Sunil's work was, again, primarily about locations and people who he was surrounded by in the south of Delhi, which is kind of like a middle-class Delhi, and people were urban English-speaking college graduate who was standing in front of their house or in their neighborhood. And I said to him that, what about people like me, where they would go to the party, or people who are not been to the party? So we couldn't afford to go to the parties.
Priced out.
And so basically we restarted that project. That, I think that was kind of like, I see that was my one of the first collaboration with him, to force him to think about all the other people who could not go to the party. And we restarted that, and it became like a massive, sort of like a 50 portrait series. Like there are like 50
It became
people.
A book eventually. We did a book for a New York publisher called Delhi.
Communities of belonging,
where we looked at 17 characters in Delhi across the social hierarchies. Because between us, we knew
range of
class
people.
And upper middle class, kind of, just to put them all into one volume, really. So how everybody dealt with their queer side, you know.
Basically, we got commissioned after when I finished my MA, and we were both in London, and the law changed in India. In 2009, it was decriminalized, and in 2013 it was recriminalized. So we were given commission to make a work about India, and then we thought, like, it's impossible to make work about India because India is a massive country, not like Australia as a landscape, but it's a very big
population. It's the biggest population, I believe.
Yeah, one of them. A book about India.
Or a a PhD about India, and you know, you talk.
It's kind of a bit of a silly commission, right? Like that idea of quintessentially summing up. I mean, it's a very Western way of thinking about. Here we go again.
Sum it all up in one.
Sum it up here really cleanly in a few portraits.
So we decided we'll do a Delhi book because we both born and brought up in Delhi. I was living there in Delhi.
And speak the language.
And speak the language. We know much more people in that space. We know the politics. We are in and out of the politics. You know. The spaces, we understand that. So we proposed to the funders that we would like to do a city book rather than a country book. And within that space, we kind of managed to bring different kind of voices, so different kind of characters from who people who moved from different part of the country and came into the big city. So we talked about that.
So it'd be quite a broad cross-section of people then, you know, in terms of class and intersection, like all the different voices, I guess, that are situated within Delhi.
The only people we omitted were women from the underclass, from the slums, because we thought they were very vulnerable. They were more vulnerable. I mean, there were some who were willing, but we thought if they would kind of get exposed. And they have very little power in the domestic situation, you know.
And also, I think we weren't sure at that time when we were making the work that is going to change again the law.
Oh, of course.
Because it was illegal by the Supreme Court, and Supreme Court is the highest court, so we don't know is that the battle had restarted for the law, but we weren't sure that how long it'll take.
And they don't really like to change their minds.
Yeah. So in that uncertainty, we approach our friends who are
careful.
Willing to and also. And also, I think one of the other thing that it was not a exhibition. It was a book, and book has a much longer lifetime, you know. So you can omit a picture from the series, but you can't omit a page from the book when it's published. So we have to think about all of those kind of modality and thinking about, you know, ethical way of consenting, you know, finding consensual, you know, people who are willing to take risk. So it went on for 2 years. A book came out in 2016, and immediately after, a lot of people showed their interest in the book and as a project. So the people proposed us they want to show the work as an exhibition, and it went to a few places, in smaller places in the UK, and then it went to a museum in Houston, Texas, and then it traveled to India, by which time law has changed in India again in 2018. And it was part of the Kochi Biennial.
Oh, fantastic. Okay.
So it's kind of like a full cycle.
Yeah.
And in 2022, we got commissioned to make Arrival.
So this is the new work, Arrival. Yeah. So just talk to a little bit about Arrival and how that, I guess, because it does feel really lovely, actually kind of talking about the new Pre-Raphaelites and then into that book and then into the new work that you're doing now.
Yeah.
All portraits.
Yes, majority. I think the book was more sort of like
of day
people,
in the life
day in the life.
And more environmental.
Environmental and their spaces. And I think one other thing was with the, I quickly say that it, very often when we're thinking about queer life, it's always like hyper-glamorized. And, you know, a lot of glitter and a lot of that kind of performance. But we wanted to show our intimate, you know, space with our friends.
And this privacy issue that people live in slums and people live like five people to a room and bathe outside
all
on
kinds
the streets,
of things,
you know, that kind of life.
But the domestic of it, the everydayness, the lived experience.
And so along that, there was a first-person narrative also going on with each of the character. They were talking about how the law had impacted and how it doesn't or what it does to them. Basically, social life of the law. That was the kind of like key of the work, and it becomes part of the lobbying for the thing.
But and, with Arrival, it's
with Arrival was slightly different. It was
quite different. It was a commission. It was very specifically aimed at an event. It was the Commonwealth Games took place in Birmingham in 2022.
Yes.
And so we got permission through the cultural funds of the Commonwealth Games via an arts organization to essentially produce public art.
Yes.
And so we decided we would make portraits of LGBTQ asylum seekers to the UK. It's possible to seek asylum to the UK on that basis. So there's a number of people who've arrived and who are in a kind of holding while they're being processed kind of thing.
Yes,
so,
it's very similar.
And they
here.
Come from a range of places, Africa, South Asia, of course, and some from Eastern Europe, Russia, you know, and some even from Latin America, Venezuela, and places where it's tough.
So you took portraits, and then they were public art
displayed. Put out on the street. One public hoardings on the road.
In a gay village where the gay center was for the games.
Okay.
So it's basically, it's kind of like public spaces, and a lot of them are coming also from the Commonwealth, right? People who are seeking asylum in the UK. So it's kind of like confrontational on the street.
They were life size.
Yeah.
And, fantastic.
Yeah.
And so it was curious because we worked with an NGO that works with them because the British have very anti-stance on any kind of asylum seeking and migration, as you know. So they make it as hard as possible. One thing they do is scatter them everywhere across the country. So they live in very isolated ways, you know, on the fringes of the UK. So to get them together is always very complicated. And then, of course, they have no means because they're not hardly given any money, you know. So this NGO was helping. So they called a meeting and got people to come who were interested. And
yeah.
So there was a core group of people who came, and then we discussed doing these pictures. And so some people didn't want to be exposed, and some felt it would be an advantage to their case, because one of the core questions is, are you really lesbian or gay? Like, how do you prove it?
Yeah, so I think that becomes...
The person will ask you across, and like, prove it.
Because,
I don't know.
Yeah, so if you're seeking asylum on the basis of your queer identity, sometimes you've been asked that, how do you prove that, you know, you're gay or lesbian or trans or anything? And
of them thought being in the project would be great.
And
proof.
With that, I...
Yes, here you go. Here is I am here. Yeah, my declaration, my evidence, as such.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it's also, I think, one of the questions which is inbuilt in that question, that are you gay or not, is that how do you recognize that gayness or queerness? Because they're coming from a country where queer identity has been suppressed. So, and we are thinking in that space in the first world, where everything is kind of like open and out, and they're kind of like examples of queerness when we have shows like in, you know, big galleries where Kiss My Gender and these kind of like things in the UK. And so how can you identify that queerness into the queerness from the coming from
Cameroon
or smaller town?
Yeah.
So for a lot of the people, for them, queerness became the rainbow flag or rainbow something, because that's the kind of symbolism that they identify with. And in fact, we were thought like, oh, we are too over rainbow flag. But I think it meant so much in that space for that person. So we are, you know, people wanted to have a rainbow something like a T-shirt or something. Some of them wear those kind of colorful, but some of them are
bits of national costume or color or something.
To show that they come from that.
I mean, the Russian guy wanted to be naked on a bear skin. I mean, he didn't think he could be naked on a billboard in England.
Yeah.
So
it's interesting, though, going back to what you were saying about that nationhood.
Yes.
And how so much of it is divvied up, and, you know, kind of probably really deep in...
Deep, yeah.
Then with the queerness and the difference of, I guess, time and Western, you know, influence, but also even things of family and self-identity, of how we all... have our own different ways of essentially presenting ourselves that's safe, that has a community, and what the boundaries are so different for so many different people.
Yeah, but it's interesting how it's American culture, so the rainbow spread everywhere. And people who've never heard of Dorothy know about the rainbow.
Yes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But I think some of the people who were using their cultural symbols or fabrics or clothes or whatever they can hold on to is also, I think, kind of like giving a message to the fellow other people from that country that, you know,
it's
there's
okay.
a possibility also. If I can do it, maybe you can also do it. Because it's like what's happening right now in Ghana, that, you know, there's a bill passed that identifying with LGBT identity, LGBT, that it can be prosecuted.
So that's why we called it Arrival, because they're arriving into something.
Okay.
And it was kind of what happened to me. Because if I hadn't left India at 15, and I hadn't chosen to escape, but I would probably have been a married guy who had some boys on the side, which is what all my peers did and what Asians are supposed to do.
Yeah.
My dad said, get married, have a son. Nobody cares who you're sleeping with, actually, but what you need is a boy who's going to do your funeral rites, who's going to send you on to the next, you know, all that business, and who's going to inherit the land and all
And it is an interesting play, isn't it, in terms of tradition and family, cultural heritage, but also personal journey and acknowledgement of our identity.
So, most of my life, you see, I'd seen the continuity of my life disrupted by this departure from India.
Okay.
From this very strong cultural site to Canada, which seemed to have like very little going in terms of culture. I don't mean to
But
you know what I mean? Like it didn't have the 5,000 years like staring you in the face every day.
But also maybe as a migrant too. I mean that idea of, you know, you've come from that really intense culture and essentially you're tourists, even though living there and as a migrant, the perception of what their history is or what's significant is going to always be different.
So actually, I figured out finally, I did a PhD recently about this, that actually I was looking at it the wrong way. I should have looked at it from the point of view I arrived somewhere, which gave me a new possibility, you know.
Yeah, it's a fantastic way of thinking. There's a beautiful book by Sean Tan, a kid's book called The Arrival. And it's dark, but there are, I think, symbols in that that significance of what does it mean to arrive, you know, and the past that we bring into that, but also the opportunity too. But I also think it's quite complex what you're trying to talk about in the project, The Arrival, of asylum seekers with, you know, queer identities, the idea of having to prove that as also a form of activism, as you were saying, Sharam, you know, here's the representation. Here's a possibility of starting anew, but also maybe starting to be the person you want to be. As a final question for both of you, you're really strong activists and I guess advocates for queer voices. And definitely for you, Sana, you've written a lot on it. You're very much a figure that we look at and see as representing your own identity, but broader communities within queer voices and Indian male queer voices. How do you feel about that? Is it exhausting sometimes? Is it liberating? How do you feel, both of you, I guess, in terms of your art practice, but as representation and a voice towards that?
Well, for me, it's been a very personal journey, because when I was in art school, I finished in 83 at the Royal College of Art. There was no mention of anything outside Europe, or very little, and there was no mention at all of anything gay, again, not outside Europe for sure. So I seem to have no antecedents. So I made it my business to put Indian gay men into art history. That was my project.
Thank you.
And so finally, some work about Indian gay men was bought by MoMA and is now on permanent display. So I feel like it happened. Yeah, I could just like sit back now, but other people do something.
I guess, I think art making or that kind of thing is always a very personal thing, you know. And as we were earlier talking that, you know, very often the subject of desires are always a subject of the center. And how do you then make the subject of desire in the periphery or in other spaces? And how those kind of, and especially, in the colonial narratives of people. So what I'm doing at the moment is to thinking about these kind of minor narratives or minor figures of the histories or paintings, and who are like always somewhere else on the background, thinking about bringing those kind of voices forward and creating fake archives, because archives is something which a lot of people are making so much emphasis on, but the archives are not full thing, because they are missing archives of people. They are missing, and there are people who are living still, like in my case, that a lot of the Kothis, the underclass queer identity, they are still living. And I think I see them as like a living archives, and kind of emphasizing on the oral tradition, because that's passed on. Because and the museums and all those kind of things have based, very much focused on the object basis.
Documentation. And there's no written archives.
Yeah, a lot of them have no. So a lot of my methodology is also thinking about like faking it.
Yeah.
And kind of like making disruption of that.
Fantastic. That yeah. I'm really excited. Look, thank you both so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Out of the Frame is supported by RMIT University Press Play Studio, is produced by Pia Johnson, sound engineering by Alex Edward, music by Steph O'Hara, and graphic design by Brent Leidovitz.